Sponsorship of this KQED podcast is provided by California College of the Arts, offering extension courses focused on design, fine arts, and digital technology. Campuses in Rock Ridge, Oakland, and Potrero Hill in San Francisco. cca.edu/extension.
Funds for the California Report are provided by the California Healthcare Foundation, supporting ideas and innovations to improve healthcare for all Californians. On the web at chcf.org. And URS, a global engineering and construction firm headquartered in San Francisco, providing engineering, construction, and technical support to public agencies and private companies. URS.com.
This is the California Report. I'm Scott Schaefer. On today's show, revenues are up, unemployment is down, but Jerry Brown holds the line on new spending. Is he being cheap or smart or both? Also, voters will elect a new mayor next week in Los Angeles, a city that ain't what it used to be.
30 years ago, L.A. was a business town with labor having a very small role. Now labor is big enough to actually be sometimes unpopular. That's really a huge shift in the politics of Los Angeles.
Plus, our graduation day series continues with an undocumented student whose future is bright but uncertain.
If I work hard here and I get my PhD, my whatever it is, and they somehow deport me, all my hard work would be for nothing.
It's the California Report. In the 40-plus years Jerry Brown has been in California politics, he's been called a lot of things: brilliant, wacky, unpredictable, loner. And this week, as he unveiled his state budget proposal, he described himself as something else, a backstop against irrational exuberance.
Everybody wants to see more spending. That's what this place is. It's a big spending machine. You need something? Come here and see if you can get it. Well, but I'm the backstop at the end. And I'm going to keep this budget balanced as long as I'm around here.
So is this Jerry Brown 2.0 or vintage Brown going back to the future, reminding everyone that he's no tax and spend liberal? Sacramento Bee columnist Dan Walters has covered the Capitol and Jerry Brown for most of Brown's quixotic career, and he joins us now. And first of all, Dan, let me just put that very question to you. Is Brown's characterization of himself this week as, you know, kind of restrained, prudent, and so on, is that the same Jerry Brown who was governor the first time?
It really is kind of the same Jerry Brown. He's always been a little cheap, and there's always been a kind of a conflict, an internal conflict, if you will, between Jerry, the bleeding heart liberal, and Jerry, the skinflint. I remember he used to say that teachers should be satisfied with psychic rewards rather than higher salaries, for example, years ago. He took away bureaucrats' briefcases then. Since now, he takes away their cell phones.
And how did it go over the first time around? Was he someone who got along pretty well with Democrats that controlled the legislature? And are we seeing that this time? Or are there some, you know, perhaps storm clouds on the horizon where he may be disagreeing with some of the priorities he's laying out?
Well, the big difference is that his parsimoniousness in those days, Jerry Brown 1.0, was more symbolic and rhetorical than it was actual. He really didn't care very much about governing California in those days. He was running for something all the time. He ran for governor in 74. He ran for president in 76. He ran for re-election in 78. He ran for president again in 80. And he ran for the U.S. Senate in 82. So his first governorship was basically one extended political campaign. He really wasn't very much interested in what happened in California. One year, in fact, he signed the budget without making a single line item veto. He just didn't really care that much. This time he's really engaged in governing, and therefore that cheapness actually has an effect. It's not just rhetoric. It's not just symbolic acts. He actually kind of more or less practices what he preaches. And I say more or less because he's not really being as frugal or as budget balancing minded as he pretends to be in this particular case.
Meaning what?
Well, the budget is balanced on paper only if one ignores certain things. Yes, the budget would pay all of the bills that the state would have to pay during the forthcoming year, but it borrows more money. It borrows $500 million from the cap and trade fund. It basically borrows a bunch of money from counties by taking money from them and then saying, we'll figure out later how much you really owe us on some very complicated budgetary maneuvers. And it ignores some very serious matters that basically does nothing. It does nothing, for example, about the California Teachers Pension Fund's request for $4.5 billion more a year. It says it needs to remain solvent. It does nothing about the long-term and ever-growing unfunded liability for state employee retiree health care. So it's balanced, but if you were to take care of all of those things and you wouldn't borrow the money that he's borrowing and all that stuff, you really put all that into the equation, this budget's about $10 billion out of whack.
Well, be that as it may, this is a relatively optimistic budget. The revenues are growing for the first time in a long time. And after all these years of cuts that Democrats have gone along with, can he stand up? Will he stand up to this, you know, what's bound to be a demand for spending at least some more money than he wants to spend on social services and other things that Democrats care about?
The answer is, I think he feels he has to for this reason. First of all, the spending that's in that budget is largely dictated by constitutional guarantees. For schools, constitutional guarantee money. And for this new money they're giving the counties for realignment, that's now in the Constitution as due to Proposition 30 passed last year. So he doesn't have an awful lot of choice about those things. The only real choice in this thing might be on the revenue side, not on the spending side. Clearly, Jerry sent orders to his bean counters to be very, very conservative on the revenue side, to not have any irrational exuberance on the revenue side, and if anything, come in on the low side. And it actually, it's kind of in a way smart politics. It's much easier to come back later, a few months later, and say, guess what? We've got some more money than we thought we had, rather than have to go back and say, guess what? We overspent what we have, and now we got to cut.
All right. Dan Walters, columnist for the Sacramento Bee. Thanks so much, as always.
You're welcome.
Well, May is not usually a month associated with elections, but Tuesday, Angelenos will choose a successor to Mayor Antonio Villaraigosa, who's termed out. Villaraigosa has had something of a stormy run as mayor, something he talked about recently with KPCC talk show host Pat Morrison.
I didn't relish furloughing thousands of city employees. I didn't feel good about the battles I've had to engage in to protect kids with teachers union. It's not something that I wanted to do going into office, but been willing to do because I firmly believe that you got to do what you believe. And that means even if it's something that's uncomfortable to do.
Vying to replace Villaraigosa in next week's runoff, two well-known politicians, L.A. City Councilman Eric Garcetti and City Controller Wendy Gruhl. Rafe Sonnenschein is following the race closely. He's executive director of the Pat Brown Institute for Public Affairs at Cal State Los Angeles. Rafe Sonnenschein, good to have you with us.
Good to be with you.
Well, let me ask you, both Wendy Gruhl and Eric Garcetti, they grew up in the San Fernando Valley. They're both L.A. political insiders, both have more than a decade at City Hall. What would you say distinguishes them other than their gender?
Well, I think there's a real difference in style and orientation. Wendy Gruhl comes out of the San Fernando Valley, represented a district that worried about overdevelopment and was very homeowner-based. And Eric Garcetti comes out of the Hollywood Council District that he still represents, which is sort of the leading edge of the kind of future urban sophistication of the city. Now, they're both a lot more complicated than that, but I think that sometimes when you look at who they've represented over the years, that's one of the big differences.
There have been some debates in this campaign, including in the runoff. And one issue in the campaign is where the candidates are getting their money and their support from. And there was a debate earlier this week on KCAL TV, and let's listen to Eric Garcetti attacking Wendy Gruhl for her support from the Department of Water and Power.
There's a clear choice in this race. The Department of Water and Power Super PAC, led by that union, has now broken all records with their partners in supporting Ms. Gruhl. I have the independence to make sure that you can have a leader who will always do the right thing.
And Rafe Sonnenschein, L.A., I assume, is a labor town, a union town. Why is that an issue?
Well, because labor has become so successful in Los Angeles that it's actually become a lightning rod for criticism as what some people call a too powerful interest group. Other people don't think that that's true. Wendy Gruhl has much more support from public sector labor unions than Eric Garcetti. Garcetti has done pretty well with private sector unions, and he also has the teachers union, which itself is a lightning rod in terms of education reform. 30 years ago, L.A. was a business town
with labor having a very small role. Now labor is big enough to actually be sometimes unpopular. That's really a huge shift in the politics of Los Angeles.
And just in the past weeks, we've seen Mayor Villaraigosa release his budget, and he's been kind of pushing back against pay increases for city employees. Is that playing out in the race at all?
Well, it's quite important because in 2007, the city council approved and the mayor signed a 25% pay increase for most city employees at the moment that the economy was in its best shape. At a recent debate, both mayoral candidates said that when they were in the council and voted for that, that was a mistake. And in January, the last element of that raise comes into effect, which is 5.5%. The mayor has proposed renegotiating that, even though there's some money kept aside in the budget for it. This is going to be a very contentious issue for the next mayor, which is how to balance the budget in light of that decision.
One thing that always matters in campaigns is biography. And let's listen to how Wendy Gruhl is describing herself vis-a-vis Eric Garcetti in this recent debate.
With all due respect to my opponent, he has, in most entire professional life, has been on the city council. I've had the opportunity to have a small family business, work in the entertainment industry at DreamWorks Studios, work for an incredible mayor, Tom Bradley.
So, Rafe Sonnenschein, there you hear her trying to describe herself as someone who hasn't spent her whole career in city government. Is that playing well? How well is it playing?
I'm not sure how important that has turned out to be. Now, Eric Garcetti likes to point out that he was a college professor at Occidental College, that he has not always been an elected official. But these are two established elected officials in the city. The reason biography is so important, though, these are not the two best-known candidates compared to previous mayoral candidates in L.A., like Jim Hahn and Antonio Villaraigosa and Tom Bradley and Richard Reardon, who were really widely known when they ran. So in a way, each candidate has been kind of telling their story to the voters only a week before the election, are still sort of introducing themselves and still trying to build that kind of core constituency that can carry them to victory in a very low turnout election.
And then final question, Rafe, what kind of city is the winner going to inherit? What kind of shape is LA in?
I think LA is actually in pretty good shape. It's certainly in better shape than it was several years ago. The crime rate has really gone down. Mass transportation is really underway. The budget has come through the worst of it. Now, of course, there's a lot of obstacles ahead having to do with pensions and long-term fiscal sustainability. I think the trouble the city has that the mayor's going to have to grapple with is the basic physical condition of the city, the streets, the neighborhoods, the sidewalks, the things that voters see every single day. A lot of that has drifted in Los Angeles in recent decades. And I think, if anything, two candidates who are not so well known, like Wendy Gruhl and Eric Garcetti, might be better positioned to really sort of take care of that business from here on.
The nuts and bolts of governing.
Absolutely. At the street level, at the neighborhood level, where people really see it.
All right. Rafe Sonnenschein is Executive Director of the Pat Brown Institute for Public Affairs at Cal State Los Angeles. Rafe, thanks so much.
It's my pleasure.
As Rafe Sonnenschein suggested, the next mayor of L.A. will have plenty of nitty-gritty issues to tackle, including homelessness. Some 2,500 people are living on the streets in L.A.'s infamous Skid Row. It's not the kind of place you'd expect to find clowns or balloon artists. But now, a new group of volunteers is throwing birthday parties for homeless kids. As part of our occasional series, What's Your Story?, Caitlin Esch introduces us to Mary Davis, who moonlights on Skid Row as the mascot Skitty Cat.
Skitty Cat is a cat, and she has amazing pink sunglasses and a pink skirt, because she's really sassy, but she's lovable. I like the fact that I have a fat suit underneath, because I get a belly, and I get to, you know, play with that. There's two hula hoops inside, so I can move them around to make my hips shake. I was an elephant in college at the University of Alabama. I was also a mascot in Katy, Texas. I was a Katy Tiger. This suit is the best suit I've ever worn, and the children love Skitty Cat.
And without further ado, Lorinda and Skitty Cat, yay!
For a kid, it's fun, character, but also it's something they attach to so quickly because it's lovable. And most of the kids here are in need of affection.
What's your name?
Melani.
Melani, we have a present for you, too. Happy birthday.
Oh, you have to wear the crown because you're the birthday girl. We had a girl at one of our birthday parties tell us that her dad left them. He left her on her birthday. And so she was telling one of the volunteers, you know, I really don't like birthday parties because my dad left on that day. So, you know, the volunteer told her, look, you know, we're going to think about you on your birthday. And just know that you are special to us and we care about you. And she said, thanks. So Skid Row can be a pretty crazy place at times. There is a lot of drug activity on the streets. I've seen children that have been homeless and their parents don't come to the Union Rescue Mission or can't get in, and they do live in a tent on the street here in Skid Row. It's really tough in a shelter. You don't get to leave the shelter. Usually the moms are under a strict program and they have to take their drug tests. They have to be here at certain times. So it's, you know, the kids can't really come and go to their friend's birthday party at school. It might not be feasible. So this is a time to really love on all of them. They all get party favors. They all get hats. They all get cake. So they all feel special when they leave.
Happy birthday to you.
And we just want to show these kids that, yeah, you might be in a shelter. You might not always get the most attention. Your dad might not be with your family anymore. But hey, you know what? You're pretty special and you're worthy of love.
That's Mary Davis, also known as Skitty Cat. Check out a picture of her in costume and listen to more of our What's Your Story series at californiareport.org. Comprehensive immigration reform inched forward in Washington this week when a bipartisan group in the House of Representatives reached agreement on how to address key issues like a path to citizenship. No one has more riding on the outcome than the 11 million or so undocumented immigrants living in the U.S. Many of them are young people, students anxious about their futures. As part of our series Graduation Day, Jasmine Lopez brings us the story of one high school senior struggling to balance his courage and his fears.
My name is Marco Perez. I am undocumented and unafraid.
Unafraid. It's taken Marco Perez a long time to openly say that he's undocumented. He grew up in Los Angeles, but always knew he was brought to the United States as a child without proper documentation. Marco says he's felt like an outsider his whole life. His biggest fear, deportation to Mexico, a country he doesn't know.
Literally, like a bus above.
At his high school in Boyle Heights, just east of downtown LA, Marco's part of the Dreamers Club. It's a peer support group for students like him.
Like, no human being is illegal, like, immigration reform for everyone. You know?
In my sophomore year, I joined the Dreamers Club. I had other students, other peers who were undocumented, like me. Because it wasn't like everybody in my high school was like, oh, hey, I'm undocumented. No, they would keep it a secret.
After a year in the club, Marco grew tired of living in fear and wanted to be proud of who he was. At 17, he did something that more and more undocumented students are willing to do.
Last year, I participated in civil disobedience to protest against Lee Baca and his unlawful deportations. But most importantly, I did it for myself. I thought that I needed that motivation, that courage.
Marco believed his protest against L.A. County Sheriff Lee Baca was one way to free himself from the fears and shame he carried throughout his life. But with this courage came uncertainty. Marco was one of five undocumented students arrested that day. Since he came here as a child, he qualified for deferred action. The 2012 program allows young people like him to work here and be protected from deportation for 2 years. But his arrest threatened that.
It kind of made me just a little bit afraid that the one opportunity that has been given to me, possibly citizenship or even just this deferred action, might be taken away.
One afternoon, anxious to move forward with his deferred action application, Marco calls a lawyer in search of a clear answer. Was his record affected by the civil disobedience?
No, I just really thought that you were the lawyer representing me, but I guess I was wrong. Because I thought I had a case where I had to go to court and everything.
Where can I just find out about my case? Who can I ask?
The lawyer isn't able to answer the question that's been eating away at Marco, but he and his mother continue with his deferred action application anyway. During a car ride through Boyle Heights, his mother tells him all they can do at this point is wait and see if it's God's will to make it happen. Marco's mother has to remind him to stay out of trouble and be on alert because of his status. She's scared about the future. He's scared too. He does well in school and just found out he received a scholarship to Cal State LA.
If I work hard here and get my PhD, my whatever it is, and somehow they somehow deport me, all my hard work would be for nothing.
Even something as simple as sneaking under a fence at a middle school field to play soccer with his friends has him on edge.
And I would just end up in a country where I can't really speak the language. And I would just have to start all over again. It's a very scary situation.
Get your quiz out and work on your quiz.
During a geometry tutoring session at Marco's school, he and his friends discuss college application deadlines. As a peer counselor, he often checks in to make sure his friends aren't falling behind.
I got rejected from Harvard, so I don't want to go to San Diego. I don't know why I applied there. Now I'm just scared.
I'm scared, man.
So I'm looking forward to graduation, going to college. I want to cling to the hope that I have that I can become a citizen in the United States. Because I just want to live like a normal life, you know. It's just stop being afraid, stop being embarrassed.
Marco's still waiting to hear back about his deferred action application. He's decided on Cal State LA, but he remains anxious, wondering if deportation looms around the corner. For the California Report, I'm Jasmine Lopez in Los Angeles.
That story was produced in collaboration with the USC Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism. Next week, our Graduation Day series continues with a straight-A student who uses poetry to navigate questions of race and isolation. The press release for Sun Moon, the new album by veteran Bay Area band The Orange Peels, says that the quartet, quote, finds itself navigating the confluence of post-rock, indie pop, space rock, nouveau psychedelia, and prog rock, with melody as its only compass. And then it adds with a little bit of cheekiness, that's probably what some critic will say anyway. Well, our critic, Steve Hockman, says that's about right. Here's his review.
For a genre that pretty much owes its existence to the most inventive, most chance-taking, most unorthodox of popular music icons, perhaps you've heard of the Beatles, the style known as power pop has by and large been locked, frustratingly, into orthodoxy. For decades, the realm has produced a parade of acts seeming to have the goal of sounding like their heroes, rather than being as creative, distinctive, and individualistic as the heroes. So when any nominally power pop band shows even the slightest sense of invention, it can seem, well, heroic. Seems like the ones and zeros have become your new heroes. Put me in a field of green, wipe that hard drive clean. Maybe it's brash that the Orange Peels titled one of the songs from its new Sun Moon album, Your New Heroes. Maybe it's tongue-in-cheek. Maybe it's commentary on slavish hero worship. Whatever the intent, it's one of the clear examples that on Sun Moon there's more than the slightest sense of invention. Each song, at the very least, brings new ideas and idiosyncratic twists to old forms, the kind of things that made such acts as Big Star, Squeeze, and Crowded House their own name brands within the larger form. At its best, as on the 70s referencing Bicentennial Bridge, Sun Moon holds the kind of playful, experimental spirit that marked one of power pop's most individualistic figures, Todd Rundgren.
Taking a chance.
The trick with Sun Moon is that after more than 15 years and four albums of enticingly formalist, though not formulaic, variations on familiar styles, the Orange Peels took some new approaches. In the past, singer and primary songwriter Alan Clapp came in with material largely written and ready to go. But with other projects occupying him, co-founding bassist Jill Pries convened the band for collective writing and recording sessions marked by a sense of freedom. Some other changes also stimulated creativity, as John Moorman, who had bounced between drums and guitar in the past, concentrated on the latter role, and new drummer Gabriel Cohen introduced ideas and aesthetics from his experience with experimental electronics. The song Grey Holiday plays it pretty straight with 60s soft haze sounds. But the next song, Ether Tide, pushes it with a glorious arrangement that could be a psychedelicized version of current folk pop stars The Lumineers. If the somber mid-album medley Traveling West, Sundowns, seems an inevitable, almost obligatory Brian Wilson nod, the Sunny Skies closer Yonder transcends its inspirations. With an extended instrumental coda, in come synthetic strings and a rhythmic looseness recalling, a little, the end of Strawberry Fields Forever by that group, oh, what were they called? But it's about creativity, not copying. Heroic? Okay, not really. But on Sun Moon, the Orange Peels make music both tart and colorful enough to match the band's name, and to fulfill the true spirit of power pop, not just the sound.
Steve Hockman is a Los Angeles-based writer who covers pop music for the California Report. He reviewed Sun Moon by the Orange Peels. The Peels' drummer, Gabriel Cohen, by the way, he moonlights as part of KQED's online team. And guitarist John Moorman is married to our director, Susie Racho. I'd say perfect harmony all the way around. And that's the California Report, a production of KQED Public Radio in San Francisco. Our director this week is Nina Thorson. The technical producer is Seal Muller. We had additional engineering from Howard Gelman. The online team includes Lisa Pickoff-White, David Marks, and Don Clyde. Thanks, as always, to our interns, Guy Marzorati and Gina Shalaba. Our editorial team includes Victoria Maleone, Susie Racho, Ingrid Becker, Bruce Kuhn, and Raul Ramirez. I'm Scott Schaefer. Thanks for listening. Have a great weekend. This is the California Report.
Funds for the California Report are provided by the James Irvine Foundation, expanding opportunity for the people of California, and supporting the California Report since its premiere in 1995. The California Teachers Association, celebrating 150 years of advocating for all students, educators, and California's public schools and colleges. And the California Endowment, Health Happens in Schools, at calendow.org.